Hey everybody, how's it going? Welcome to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here on the Liberty Express. And at scotthorton.org. And Daily Paul Radio, and I don't know, other places. Anomaly Radio. I'm on lots of different websites, man. Lots of different ones. All right. I'll be back on KPFK this week. I'm always preempted by their fun drive. I said, hey, I'll do a fun drivey type of show for you. Nah, just skip it. Okay. So, but I will be back. I've been gone for 3 weeks from KPFK, but I will be back this Sunday, at least. Got a good show lined up for you today. Let's see. I don't know. Is it the great Gareth Porter? Or is it Gareth Porter the Great? I have trouble deciding. I think the great Gareth Porter. Because Gareth Porter the Great sounds too much like Gordon Prather the Great. And he kind of already had claim on the Great at the end there, I think. Gordon the Great. Keep meaning to give him a phone call. Good old Gordon. Anyway, yeah, when it comes to debunking lies about Iran's nuclear program, your best sources' names have G and P in them. Well, old Gordon's retired now, but Gareth is still whooping ass, and he's got a brand new one. He's got two brand new ones that are very important. First of all, today at Truth Out, brand new out at truthout.org. Is Obama pins fate of nuclear pact on documents from an Iranian curveball. Oh, yeah. You already know the truth of this if you're a regular listener to this show. About the so-called alleged studies documents. But I'm learning new things about Obama's insistence that these alleged studies documents be included in the negotiations for the final deal. Barack Obama. What a jerk. Anyway, I'm going to try to save it. I'll tell you what, I'll save it. Gareth Porter's going to be on to talk about the alleged studies documents and the nuclear negotiations. Also, Ivan Elon will be on the show. You know, I don't ever interview Elon enough. Oh, you know, Fitzy suggests Super Gareth. I think I like that. Super Gareth. That's the chat room. Did I mention there's a chat room? ScottHorton.org/chat. And you can join up the chat room, hang out with Fitzy G, and say smart things to each other back and forth. Like Super Gareth. Let's see. The great Gareth Porter. Super Gareth Porter. Yeah, I think I like that. Super Gareth. Anyway, Ivan's going to be back on the show. I hardly ever interview Ivan, but I don't know why. Ivan. Island. I hardly ever interview Ivan Eland. Island for short. That's probably not original on my part. But I don't know why I don't interview him all the time, because he's great. And his writing is pretty good. But his interviews are always really good. He's a very libertarian guy. He's the author of a book called The Empire Wears No Clothes. Well, I like that. That's good. And he's also the author of Recarving Rushmore, which is about how good people, instead of horrible, blood-soaked monsters, should be the more celebrated figures in American history. By that count, I think he says John Taylor is the best president America ever had. Yeah, I know. Most historians prefer their heroes soaked in the blood of innocence, but not Ivan Eland. And he's got a new book out, too, which I'm going to be asking him about. I don't know how new it is, even. That's how bad I am on the Ivan Eland issue. But his new book is called No War for Oil. And, you know, especially for you right-wing leaning people out there, I'll have you know that Ivan is a libertarian, free market guy, way more free market than you if you're a conservative. You're a commie, pinko, Nazi compared to Ivan Elon, the free market guy, when it comes to economics. And he's from the Independent Institute, You know, and their leader there, David Thoreau, personally a very conservative guy, even though he's a hardcore libertarian anarchist. But, yeah, Anthony's a bit more radical over there. But Ivan Elon, man, he is he's a pro-capitalist type. And that's why he's such an anti-imperialist. I know that sounds funny to right-wingers, but if you just stop and think about it for a minute, I think you'll be able to work it out. Anyway, so Chuck Hagel, I mentioned this barely at the end of the show yesterday. I don't put too much stock in it. I guess it's an important subject, and since official news has brought it up, we got to talk about it. But it's this proposed, you know, 5-year plan or 7-year plan or whatever for the Pentagon that has them reducing the force in size and technological this and that, implement the light and fast, innovative Pentagon future that Donald Rumsfeld was so obsessed with back in the day, and cut down the size of the military, etc. Now, I don't think they're going to do it. I don't think they're going to save one dime, and I think reform never works. And so, yeah. But anyway, it's an important subject. If Ivan Elon was the Secretary of Defense, I'd believe in the plan. But yeah, Chuck Hagel, not so much. But anyway, so Ivan's going to be on talk about that. And, you know, I want to talk with him about the A-10 Warthog, too. Don't let me forget, chat room guys. Because part of this new budget, at least according to the New York Times version, is that they're going to cut the A-10 in favor of the F-35. Which means if your son is in infantry, they would rather bomb the enemy that your son is engaged with on the ground over there from 5 miles away with a smart bomb than fly in low where they can see what they're doing and make sure that they get the quote-unquote bad guy whose property your son is trespassing on over there. The A-10, useful weapon for the battlefield. You know, amorally speaking, useful weapon for the battlefield. Assuming that the policy of attempting to limit friendly fire casualties is one of your priorities, or one of the things you think is important, then yeah, you'd prefer the A-10 to the F-35. But the F-35 costs a lot more. But that's a reason from our government's point of view of why they prefer the F-35. Whereas to any rational person who has to, you know, work for what they've got, you would want to save a buck. Buy a few more A-10s then if you need more planes. But no, all the incentives in the empire are to waste money. And, you know, I don't know. I haven't talked with Ivan in a while. I don't really know how he's doing. But I'm thinking if he gives the most sober and boring assessment of the F-35, it's going to be the most hilarious thing you've heard all day. Because it's just hilarious what a ridiculous boondoggle this thing is. There's never been such a ripoff. You know, when I was a boy, Tom Brokaw would have The Fleecing of America. I don't know if they have that anymore. The Fleecing of America. Dude, this is the biggest ripoff ever. Are you kidding me? Hundreds of millions of dollars per jet that doesn't work. You've got to be joking. Anyway. Yeah, so I'll be asking Ivan about that. Oh, and then also, you know what? He's pro-negotiation and sunshine policy and warm relations with North Korea. And I'm pro that, too. Big time. I want a Dennis Rodman foreign policy. And I know everybody said that after the last time he was under a lot of pressure and he'd been drinking and he said something that sounded cold-hearted about a missionary over there or whatever. I don't care about any of that. The more basketball, the better. And especially if you're bringing the Harlem Globetrotters over there, because those are the greatest Americans. Certainly the best in any red, white, and blue uniform that America has to offer. And if they could do a tour of North Korea and show them what it's like to see the very best of American basketball players having fun over there, then they'll be just like us in no time. They'll have a brand new Declaration of Independence from their own government. Their own government will want to give it to them. It'll be perfect. It'll be utopia. No. It'll be better if we can open up as much exchange as we possibly can with the population and with the government of that country. And Dennis Rodman has it absolutely right. And Ivan Elon has it right that Dennis Rodman's got it right. So we're going to talk with him about that too. It's the second to last real communist country left on the planet after Cuba. On March 7th at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., the Council for the National Interest is co-hosting the first ever national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Confirmed speakers include Walt Scheuer, Giraldi, McGovern, Katowski, Porter, McConnell, Weiss, Raimondo, USS Liberty survivor Ernie Gallo, as well as co-sponsors Alison Ware of If Americans Knew and the great Grant Smith of the Institute for Research, Middle East Policy. That's the national summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. Friday, March the 7th, all day at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., natsummit.org. Hey y'all, Scott Horton here for CashIntoCoins.com. So you want to buy some Bitcoins? CashIntoCoins.com makes it fast, easy, and safe to get Bitcoins. Just deposit the money into their account at any of the major banks they support, and then just email them a picture of the receipt and your Bitcoin address, and you get your Bitcoins. Almost always the same day it clears. In a tough, competitive new market, CashIntoCoins.com has the advantage. A great system and great customer service to keep you coming back. That's CashIntoCoins.com. Just click the link in the right margin at ScottHorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Zara in the chat room makes a point about depleted uranium weapons and the A-10 polluting the entire earth with the damn things. That's true. That's absolutely, I think that's absolutely true. That their machine guns, the A-10 machine guns, use armor-piercing depleted uranium rounds, or at least can be outfitted to use them, have used them. And that is absolutely problematic. I still think it's worthwhile to point out, I mean, first of all, I don't think that we need a standing army whatsoever. That's it. Just abolish the damn thing, bring them all home. That's it. End of that. And then fire them all. And make them all get real jobs. Then it doesn't matter either way about, you know, who has an A-10 or an F-35 or whatever. But from the point of view of the military men, from the point of view of the Air Force, they don't really care about the lives of Army guys on the ground. To the Air Force, the Army might as well be a foreign country they're at war against. Or an ally, you know, like the British or the French that they're forced to have to deal with, but they still look down on. You know, everybody's a grunt this or a puke that or whatever. All the agencies hate each other. And so that's why the Air Force hates the A-10. It's not because it's depleted uranium. They hate it because it makes them serve the Army. It makes their missions dependent on Army requests for air support. And they don't want to do that. They want to wage their own war, or at least they want to fly around and pretend all Top Gun in their training missions at doing dogfights with some equal air power out there somewhere worth dogfighting. Screwing around flying in low and slow to shoot machine guns and drop small bombs on, soft targets. That's not fun. They want to fly an F-35, and if anything, if they're going to provide air support for troops on the ground, okay, fine. We'll fly our F-35 by at 500 miles an hour or 1,000 and drop a 500-pound bomb, and it may or may not hit the bad guys. It may or may not hit the Army. They don't care about that. They really don't want to participate at all in the kind of wars America fights, which is, you know, occupying other people's countries and warring against the civilians who dare to resist. So in a way, the Air Force kind of has the moral upper hand here. They just want to fight an imaginary Soviet Air Force that doesn't exist, that they'll never fight. Whereas the Army is actually bogged down killing people and they need air support. So maybe actually I got my entire argument upside down. Maybe the Army guys should just go AWOL. Then they won't need air support. That's the honorable thing to do. Just quit. And yeah, hey, I wouldn't want to go to the brig either, but wouldn't you rather go to jail than kill somebody? Isn't that weird? In civilian life, you go to jail if you kill somebody. In the Army, you go to jail if you don't kill somebody. I don't know. Close enough for government work. All right. Hey, I'm going to be on the Tom Woods Show, I guess Friday, because we're going to record it Thursday. So that should be fun. He's going to ask me about Ukraine. I better learn a lot about Ukraine there in time to talk with the man. Oh, I think it'll be fine. And I think he was going to ask me something else, too. But, yeah, you know, good old Tom. He should have known by now, but I think he did figure out once he finally got me on his show that, hey, Scott knows the answers to these questions that I have. I should interview him. So now he's going to interview me. And, you know, the first interview was, okay, tell me all about this, that, and the other thing. A lot of broad questions about, you know, we did a tour all around the Terror War and the Empire and everything else. I think from now on, he's going to want to get more specific, spend more time on certain subjects like Ukraine. And what the hell is America doing messing around in Ukraine? Russia, you better not intervene in what is clearly all of our business and none of yours. Strange how that works. Anyway. So that's coming up. All right. Hey, no, I was trying to get Glenn Greenwald on the show, and that didn't work. Oh, no. Jason says... Jason from Liberty Express says that Tom Woods' show does go up same day. So I guess I'll be on Thursday then on here on Liberty Express on the Tom Woods show right before my own show. So that's cool. I guess just recorded barely in advance. Yeah, good. Greenwald. I keep trying to get Greenwald. One time he answered me and said he'd like to. Other times he hasn't answered me again. Poor little old me. I'm going to try to get old Glenn back on the show at some point. I don't know. But anyway, he wrote something good. I want you to read it. I'm going to talk about it now. First, I got to find it. I have a link to it on my own website, scotthorton.org. You can find all my interview archives. The title is How Covert Agents Infiltrate the Internet to Manipulate, Deceive, and Destroy Reputations. And, yeah, he's got all the documents from the GCHQ, all about how to ruin people's lives digitally. And, you know, I admit, I should have reread this article closely because I read it fast last night. I should have reread it closely before the show today so I really got a good handle on it to tell you. But my impression here is, what I think is going on here is they don't really talk about terrorism at all. If you're imagining that somewhere there's a Takfiri prisoner beheader suicide bomber who is, you know, not preoccupied working for Obama in Syria right now and somehow is, you know, doing something America doesn't want and that maybe the NSA is, or the GCHQ, that these guys are going around worried about destroying those guys, I don't think that comes into it here at all. I don't think they even pretend that this is about embarrassing or neutralizing or screwing around with Ayman al-Zawahiri and friends whatsoever. This is all about the hacktivists. And they got all these documents. It's a NSA slideshow, GCHQ slideshow, I guess. And they talk about basically just how to get into online communities and COINTELPRO their asses, turn everybody against each other, smear people, mount what they call false flag attacks, like, you know, pose as half a group attacking the other half of the group for no reason, that kind of thing. I really like this this slide, identifying and exploiting fracture points. It has things that push a group together with these green arrows pointed kind of toward each other, and they've got these curves, tension in the middle. Things that push a group together, shared opposition, shared ideology, common beliefs. And then the things that pull a group apart, personal power, pre-existing cleavages, competition, ideological differences. So in other words, you know, these are government employees talking to each other about what they do. So they go, okay, for example, how do you get the American conservative... How do you get Scott Horton, the libertarian, to read Glenn Greenwald, the progressive, in the American Conservative magazine? Well, they all have to have something important in common, like they're all opposed to the empire and the depredations against our Bill of Rights, for example. We have a shared ideology, which is we want our Bill of Rights. And we have common beliefs. Like, hey, reading and writing and interviewing and talking and making hay out of the violations of our Bill of Rights is a good way to maybe help prevent further erosion. And so let's do more of that. Let's work together to help promote each other's causes to help, you know, repeal the 21st century, man. Get our Bill of Rights back, right? Yeah. Okay, so if you're the NSA or the GCHQ and you're looking at something like bipartisanship on the part of the people, not those in power, but regular people, the paleo right, the progressive, principled progressive left, and the libertarians aligning around things, priorities, like peace and the Bill of Rights, well, then all you got to do, simple enough, look for people inside the alliance who can be manipulated into breaking the alliance in order to benefit themselves. Or, for example, start bringing up extraneous issues that everybody was being polite enough to not argue about right now, like, say, for example, I don't know, abortion. When you have a lot of people who have a lot of very strong feelings on both sides of that debate, who are never going to change their mind and certainly didn't join up the new movement they're joining in order to fight about it. But now here they are. Somebody picks a fight about that. So now all of a sudden, oh, what's an occupier doing in a big tent with a Tea Party guy when these should be united around libertarian principles like no bailouts, no welfare for billionaires, no empire, no war on the Bill of Rights, when they should be aligned around those principles, when it's so easy to find something that where their differences are irreconcilable and split them back apart again. And it's just fun to see it in the Snowden documents. You can be paranoid all day about, I wonder how hard the government is working to figure out the best ways of screwing those who love liberty and keeping us from working together. And then the answer, here it is in the Snowden documents as leaked to Glenn Greenwald, as published at firstlook.org/The Intercept. Yeah, they're working very hard to figure out what do we got to do to identify coalitions that we don't like and then break them. It's like a war against democracy being waged by the democracy itself. Isn't that incredible, everybody? Isn't that important? So, yeah, I thought so too, man. That's why I like bringing it up. And they go on and on. This is a really in-depth article. You should maybe read it twice too, man, or maybe just once, but slow. I want to go back and read it. He talks about how they don't really, in the documents, describe just how much of this they're doing and getting away with. Only that, you know, this is their program, as they call it, of how to go out there discrediting people, hijacking their social media, and putting terrible words in their mouths, and making people hate them, and breaking their alliances. And certainly they admit that they're focusing on the hacktivists, the political activists who use computers. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. Don't worry about things you can't control. Isn't that what they always say? But it's about impossible to avoid worrying about what's going on these days. The government has used the war on guns, the war on drugs, and the war on terrorism to tear our Bill of Rights to shreds. But you can fight back. The 10th Amendment Center has proven it, racking up major victories. For example, when the U.S. government claimed authority in the NDAA to have the military kidnap and detain Americans without trial, the nullifiers got a law passed in California, declaring the state's refusal to ever participate in any such thing. Their latest project is offnow.org. nullifying the National Security Agency. They've already gotten model legislation introduced in California, Arizona, Oklahoma, Missouri, and Kansas, meant to limit the power of the NSA to spy on Americans in those states. We'd be fools to wait around for the U.S. Congress or courts to roll back Big Brother. Our best chance is nullification and interposition on the state level. Go to offnow.org, print out that model legislation, and get to work nullifying the NSA. The hero Edward Snowden has risked everything to give us this chance. Let's take it. Offnow.org. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. And sorry for the delay, I had to go in the other room and get a Dr. Pepper. All right, hey, Gareth the Great, Super Gareth. The heroic Gareth Porter from Inner Press Service and truthout.org is on the line. His brand new one at truthout.org is called Obama Pins Fate of Nuclear Pact on Documents from an Iranian Curveball. He also has a very important one here, which is sort of kind of in the new one, too. This one is from 2 days ago, 3 days ago at antiwar.com. U.S. adopts Israeli demand to bring Iran's missiles into the nuclear talks. We'll be talking about that as well. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks again, Scott, for giving me a chance to be on your show.
Well, very happy to have you here. So, the alleged studies, documents, the possible military dimensions, the smoking laptop of death. These are all synonyms. These are all jargon in the counter-proliferation movement or whatever for a batch of documents that surfaced, I believe, in 2004 and purported to prove that the Iranians had a secret nuclear weapons program. And now you're reporting here, at least they did at one time, and now you are reporting here, come on, these came from the MEK, which we already knew that, and you're going to prove that again. But then also that Obama has now included, just like with the missiles, has now included these so-called possible military dimensions as issues which must be resolved by the Iranians. In other words, again, beating them over the head, the old UN Security Council mandate that they must answer the endless list of questions based on these documents, which are of such dubious provenance in the first place, and how this amounts basically to a deal killer. Am I summing it up about right? Or it could amount to sabotage of the deal?
It would be a deal killer. It will be a deal killer if, in fact, the Obama administration insists that the Iranians must somehow admit to having had a nuclear weapons program. That's really the question mark that I posed in the second article that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. The first article that we're talking about, not the second one.
Right, the newest.
The one at Truthout.
Right.
On the Iranian curveball. The question is, will the administration insist that Iran is supposed to confess to having had a nuclear weapons program?
I see.
I didn't include this in the story itself, but it is in the in the book that the Bush administration in 2007, December 2007, actually publicly called for the Iranians to acknowledge that they had had a nuclear weapons program as somehow the tickets that they had to buy in order to to have any role in future discussions about anything having to do with their nuclear program. Mm-hmm. That, of course, was a non-starter. Nothing ever happened. But the question in my mind is whether the administration now actually has similar thoughts in mind. And I don't know the answer to that, but I do know that there are people in the proliferation, the arms control community, if you will, who have suggested this in print. And I think it's an idea that's been floating around, and that might well be influencing U.S. policy. That would be extremely worrisome if that were the case. But if that's not the case, then this is not really a problem, and I'll tell you why. It is a problem, but it's not nearly as much of a problem as it would be if they were seeking that confession. And what I'm talking about here is the fact that the Iranians had actually agreed to give full explanations for all of the charges that were published by the IAEA in its report, its famous November 2011 report, the dossier, if you will, of all these intelligence claims against Iran on the idea that it had a nuclear weapons program or did nuclear weapons work. They agreed to cover every one of those issues in great detail in 2012.
I see.
And
so
the
now,
only,
what
the,
you're saying
the,
then
the
is that...
The only condition that they put on it, or conditions, were that A, the United States had to share, or the IAEA had to share the documents that they were using to charge Iran, to accuse Iran of having those nuclear weapons projects, and two, that there had to be an end to the IAEA investigation. So, in other words, once those issues were resolved, they wouldn't bring up new ones.
I see.
And, of course, the second one now, I think, is taken care of. So the only issue remaining is whether the United States government is going to agree to share those documents that previously the U.S. government would not agree to have to allow Iran to have copies of. So that's really the next issue that I'm going to be writing about, actually.
Okay. So, in other words, there was a time back in, tell me if I got this right. There was a time where, I guess, Ahmadinejad's government said, listen, we're no longer going to entertain these questions. You're outside your safeguards agreement mandate. And these are the IAEA questions mandated by the Security Council that you have to answer this, that, and the other thing, including all kinds of questions unrelated, at least not directly related, to their nuclear program and that kind of thing. And at some point, the Iranians had said, no, we're not even going to cooperate with answering your unending list of questions based on these forgeries, what they're calling forgeries. But you're saying that they've changed their position. They said, no, we will answer all of that. As long
that's
as
correct.
You bring the documents with you when you ask, then we'll be able to go through
correct.
With
they,
you.
They did sort of suspend their cooperation with the IAEA investigation in 2008, and the reason was quite explicit, quite specific. They terminated, at least temporarily, their cooperation because the IAEA was demanding that Iran turn over military secrets, both in terms of its missile program, that is to say, they were asking for the specs, the actual papers showing the design of their Shahab 3 missile, which, of course, they weren't going to share with IAEA, and the IAEA knew that perfectly well. And they were asking for details of the conventional or non-military uses, but including military uses of the exploding bridge wire work that Iran had done. So, I mean, those are things that lie beyond the legitimate scope of IAEA inquiry, and the Iranians made that clear. They weren't going to talk about that. But in 2012, they negotiated an agreement in which they said, yes, we will provide full explanations, technical explanations for all of the things that you've asked about, but we want you to give full explanations for the basis for your accusation and provide us with the relevant documents.
Right.
And the IAEA at that point was not prepared to assure Iran that it would do that in every case.
Right. Okay, well, I'm Dick Cheney, and I got the 1% doctrine, and so I think that, you know, hey, man, maybe these documents are legit, and maybe they're making nukes, and we should nuke them. What do you think about that?
Arguing that the documents are legit and authentic is, of course, the default position not only of the U.S. government and its allies, but the U.S. news media as well. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience that it is very difficult to find anybody in the commercial news media who has had anything to do with this coverage of this issue who will express even the slightest doubt about these documents.
Isn't that funny? Even after what we've all been through over these last years, not just lying us into Iraq, but lying us into staying day after day for 8 years. I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, it's an astonishing failure of the news media to even pretend to play the role that they're supposed to play, which is to inquire into the truth, to question official statements, and fact-check and investigate. They don't do any of that. And there's no, you know, it's not just that, but, I mean, I've encountered, you know, some hostility on the part of some of the news media people, like reporters, who have written about national security issues, you know, with regard to my coverage of the Iran nuclear issue, because, you know, I think that they feel very much on the defensive about the role they've played, and so there's a certain tendency to lash out at me for allegedly, you know, always saying that whatever Iran says is the fact, whereas, of course, that's not what I write at all. But, I mean, I think that there is a very automatic response on the part of the news media, definitely.
Yeah.
Which reflects a sense of subconscious guilt, I think, about the role they're playing, is the way I would explain it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that could be part of it. I think also, too, that, you know, there are a bunch of truthers, and they just believe what they want, and they're anti-Iran truthers, so they can't, you know, they can't open their mind to the possibility that they're wrong in the first place. Everybody knows that they have a nuclear weapons program over there, and so any dissension, I mean, think about in 2002 and 2003 when Jude Winiski would write in defense of Saddam Hussein, I hate the bastard, but here's the truth about him, okay?
Yeah, yeah.
And everybody would just attack Jude Winiski like he was from another planet. And he's like, no, I'm a Reaganite who remembers the Reagan years. I'm just being honest about what's going on. You know?
Yeah, I mean, of course, the first recourse for those people who are trying to fend off any possible criticism of themselves, or, you know, deflect that, is to attack the bona fides of somebody who raises issues that are uncomfortable. That's certainly the case, was the case with Iraq, and now I think it's happening.
Yeah.
In this case, on Iran. But,
which is funny, because the whole slogan of this society supposedly is, hey, innocent till proven guilty, since we're all born free and have a natural right to be free and everything. The burden of proof is on the accuser. The burden of proof, especially when it's a worn-out conspiracy theory like Iran has been making nukes for 25 years, but they never have gotten around to making one yet. The burden of proof is on the ones making the accusations, not on you, who's just pointing out that their accusations are hollow.
The answer to that, of course, is that
we have to go out to break.
In the United States, as anywhere else, I mean, when you have enormously powerful vested interests, then the truth doesn't really prevail at all. That's the way it happens.
Right back in a sec. Hey, y'all, Scott here. You like coffee? Me too. Hey, if you're a true connoisseur, you need to try an amazing new roaster out of L.A., Tonks Coffee. These guys are fanatical about delivering the best coffee beans in the world. They get the beans directly from the growers, roast them, and then ship them to you within 24 hours. They're as fresh as can be. Tonks is a subscription-only service, and they're offering a free sample to listeners to this show. Give it a try. If you like it, you can sign up. Then every 2 weeks, you get a new batch of incredible coffee beans roasted to perfection. If you're hitting the cafe or drive-thru most mornings, this is a better and more economical way to get great coffee. Go to tonks.org/liberty. That's tonks.org/liberty. Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way, the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world, except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. You can find all my interview archives there. More than 3,000 of them now, going back to 2003. And we're in the middle of talking with Gareth Porter, author of Manufactured Crisis, the brand new book, Manufactured Crisis, about the Iranian nuclear program. And we're talking about this new piece at truthout.org, Obama pins fate of nuclear pact on documents from an Iranian curveball. And curveball, of course, is a reference to the, secretary of Ahmed Chalabi's brother, I think, was the guy posing as an Iraqi biological weapons expert, and he was the source of Colin Powell's cartoon drawings of what mobile biological weapons labs in Iraq might look like were they to exist, in his great presentation before the United Nations back in, January of 2003, there on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. And so in this case, curveball is not a reference to the Iraqi National Congress, but the same damn difference. It's the Mujahideen e-Kulk, the communist terrorist cult that used to work for Khomeini and then against Khomeini and then for Hussein and then for Don Rumsfeld and now for the Israelis. Maybe the Israelis for a longer period of time throughout that part. Anyway. So now, MEK cult, Gareth, you say they are the source of the so-called alleged studies documents, and that's why no one should worry about a thing that they say in there.
That's a primary fact, I think, and this is really what I consider to be the one headline story in my book that deserves to be really published in the news media around the world, which is that not only do we know now that the Mujahideen e-Kulk turned these weapons over to the German intelligence agency, the BND, but that the BND, senior officials of the BND, were so upset that Colin Powell in November 2004 made public reference to information that they knew he was getting from these documents that the MEK had turned over to them, that they considered that it was likely that the Bush administration was going to try to do the same thing on Iran that they'd done on Iraq. And they were quite alarmed by this, specifically because, of course, they had been the ones that turned over the information that Curveball had generated about these wild stories of mobile bioweapons labs to the CIA, and then that turned up, in, as you had just said, in Colin Powell's UN speech as the centerpiece of the case for war against Iraq. And now they saw Colin Powell publicly talking about information from this other BND source. It wasn't a spy for them. They just somebody that they occasionally got information from. And they considered that source to be doubtful. They did not think that it was a reliable source that the United States should be citing as the basis for policy.
And how do you know
and
that?
This is information that came from Carsten Voigt, who was then the coordinator of North American-German relations in the German Foreign Office. He had been in that position since 1997. Before that, he'd been a member of the SPD, the Social Democratic Party of Germany, in the German Parliament. And indeed, he had become the spokesperson for the SPD in the Parliament. And when the SPD candidate, Gerhard Schroeder, was elected chancellor, he was elevated to the senior position in the Foreign Office. And so it was to this individual, this senior official of the Foreign Office, that the BND, the high-ranking BND officials went when they were concerned about what the United States was doing with this information that they knew they'd gotten from the same documents that the MEK had turned over to them. Mm-hmm. And they asked him, in effect, what can we do about this? And a few days later, as I show in my book, Carsten Voigt talked to the Wall Street Journal and told the journal, look, these documents should not be relied upon as the basis for policy. And they came from a dissident group, an Iranian dissident group. So clearly he was carrying out what he believed was the desire of the senior officials of the BND in doing that. Mm-hmm. So he gave me the full story for my book in an interview last year. This is the first time that the details have been revealed.
All right. Now, was it the MEK commie terror cult that forged the documents in the first place, Gareth?
No. I mean, in my book, I make the case based on admittedly circumstantial evidence and logic rather than the testimony of some defector or something like that. That it was the Israelis who fabricated those documents. I've said so many times The reasoning, there are multiple reasons for believing this. I think the most pertinent one is that the MEK is known to have served to launder intelligence that the Israelis came up with or created, and which they did not want to have it known came from the Israelis themselves. They did this on several occasions, and there's every reason to believe that these were not something that the MEK was capable of fabricating. This was a very clever job. It served the political diplomatic purposes of Israel perfectly at that moment. It fit into their strategy, and the Israelis had already an office in the Mossad, which had the responsibility for actually influencing foreign governments and news media. So, you know, it's virtually impossible that it was anyone else except the Israelis who fabricated these documents.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, the CIA and all the other American intelligence agencies, 16 or 17 of them, depends on who you ask, I think, they come together from time to time as requested by the president or by the Congress in some circumstances to form the National Intelligence Council and produce a National Intelligence Estimate, which is supposed to represent the conclusions of the heads of all of the different intelligence agencies. And that's a lot of them. And as is well known, they came out in November 2007 and they said that Iran used to have a secret nuclear weapons program, but they halted it in 2003, and they have not made the political decision to pursue it any further since then. And, of course, as everyone probably already knows, hopefully already knows, Clapper, when he's not perjuring himself, the director of national intelligence, likes to testify before the Senate under oath that that's still the conclusion. They stand by that. They even did a whole new NIE, I believe, at the end of 2010, beginning of 2011, you know, reaffirming that same conclusion. And yet they say that there was a secret nuclear weapons program of some description up to 2003. Are they talking only about these alleged studies documents, or do they have some other evidence that there actually ever was a nuclear weapons program there in the first place? Gareth, what do you think? And I know we talked about your recent report where they had been wrong since 92 based on some dual-use technology and that kind of thing, but then they figured out, they agreed with you about that, that they had been wrong about those conclusions, so that's not what they're referring to, right?
You're right. The NIE in 2007 was based on more than the documents that were turned over by the MEK, and I'll get to that point in just a moment. But first of all, it should be understood that despite the fact that that there was more information that they had, that group of analysts were very much influenced by the belief that the documents that we're talking about here were genuine, were authentic. And I got that. I specifically asked Thomas Singer, who was in charge of that whole NIE process, you know, what was your view of these documents? Did you assume that they were authentic or not? And his answer was, which you find in my book, those documents did in fact help us to understand that that Iran did in fact had the intention of getting nuclear weapons, whereas prior to those documents, as he put it, the Iranian nuclear intention was more ambiguous. So he very strongly confirmed that the working assumption of that team was that the documents were authentic and that indeed Iran had a nuclear weapons program. And of course, one should not forget that until the summer of 2007, after the team had drafted an initial draft of the estimate, they still believed that the Iranians had still been working on a nuclear weapons program as of that day. They still believed that there was a nuclear weapons program going on until they came up with this new information. They obviously cracked the computers of some people in the military-industrial complex of Iran and found some messages in which some one or more, I'm not clear on this, I don't think it's ever been clear whether it's one person or more than one person, had expressed anger or being upset that they had been stopped from working on nuclear weapons projects.
Yeah, they even had an Onion headline like that about frustrated Iranian scientists being forced to halt their work. Hang on. Can I keep you one more segment here, Gareth? I want to ask you about the missiles and the talks, too.
Okay.
All right, we'll be back at 6 after, so take a break. Man, you need some new stickers for the back of your truck. Scott Horton here for LibertyStickers.com. Aren't you sick and tired of everyone else being wrong about everything all the time? Well, now you can tell them all what's right with some stickers from LibertyStickers.com. At LibertyStickers.com, they're against everything, so you know they're good on your issue, too. Whether it's the wars, police state, gun laws, the left and right, or the president, LibertyStickers.com has hundreds of choices so you can find just the right words to express your opposition and contempt for those who would violate your rights. That's LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. You ever get the idea that people reading the news for the top of the hour news have no idea what they're talking about? The Second Amendment protects Pierce Morgan's right of free speech. Really? I guess in a roundabout way it kind of does, doesn't it? Whether he would like to admit it so or not. All right. Well, whatever. I'll give you a quarter points. It's the Scott Horton Show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the phone with Gareth Porter the Great. Super Gareth. Author of Manufactured Crisis about Iran's nuclear program. I say that because I forget the actual technical sub-headline on it. But anyway, it's called Manufactured Crisis. It's for sale right now. Go buy it. He's got a new piece at Truthout. Obama pins fate of nuclear pact on documents from an Iranian curveball. And then also, U.S. adopts Israeli demand to bring Iran's missiles into nuclear talks. And this one, don't get me sidetracked on this Barack Obama character and how I can't figure out his crappy diplomacy. But anyway, tell us all about this Israeli demand that America bring Iran's missile program into the nuclear talks. Sounds like maybe that's important. Maybe not.
But I'll be glad to answer that, Scott, but first I want to make sure we don't leave hanging in the air the rest of the answer to the question that you posed before the break, and that was about the National Intelligence Estimate and its conclusion that there was, in fact, a nuclear weapons program from 2001 to 2003. And, of course, just as I was saying before we broke, they did, in fact, intercept communications from somebody who was angry that he had been prevented from continuing to pursue research that related to nuclear weapons. Now, the rest of the answer is this, that there's no information made available by the people who did that estimate as to what the person or people were working on. What kind of research it was? Was it tabletop research? Was it on the back of an envelope? Was it, was it field research testing parts of a nuclear weapon? It makes a big difference, of course, what kind of research they were doing. It also makes a difference whether they had, in fact, done this research as part of a government-approved nuclear weapons program. There's no evidence presented and no additional evidence to support the idea that there was, in fact, a nuclear weapons program. And when I quizzed Tom Finger about this, as people will see if they get my book, he was not willing to say anything more about it, except that he implied very strongly that, well, this is sources and methods. But I strongly criticize that suggestion on the basis of that there were leaks to the news media, not leaks, there were briefings for news media in which they did talk about sources and methods. They talked about, the kind of sources that they used to get this information and the type of people who were, in fact, whose communications were picked up. So they went very far towards revealing sources and methods, What they didn't reveal was the substance. So that's why I think that NIE is extremely flawed. It's been highly misunderstood, and I think mm-hmm. people who care about this will be interested to read the entire story from my book. So now let me turn to the missile issue very quickly. I think, you know, this whole business of Obama administration now saying that Iran has to discuss in the nuclear talks their ballistic missile program is really a kind of false issue. I think that it was put forward almost completely for political reasons, for domestic political reasons, to fend off criticism from the Israeli lobby people in the Senate, particularly, who have been extremely aggressive on this issue of why didn't you, the Obama administration, do something in the nuclear talks about the Iranian missile program? Here they're being allowed to continue their work on missiles. So Wendy Sherman, the chief negotiator on the issue of the Iranian nuclear program, goes before the Senate and says, oh, well, we didn't do anything in the interim agreement, but believe you me, we're going to do something about it in the final agreement. You just watch. And so they basically came up with this idea that now Iran has to talk about its ballistic missile program. But all the while, they knew perfectly well that that was not going to fly. The Russians would never agree to go along with that. And in the end, they won't be able to get a consensus among the P5+1. So it's really the same thing as they say in the National Football League. It's a free play. They can kind of just, you know, play the hard line for their hardliner critics in the Senate, while at the same time knowing that they're not really going to be able to do anything about this in the talks. I think it's just a free play, which is just once again a political ploy by the Obama administration.
Which, you know, I guess that's fine, as long as they don't, you know, push it too hard and you know, end up bluffing so bad that they actually screw everything up. But I understand there's a lot of pressure
here
from the right.
How do they, I mean, of course they can say, well, we tried, but we couldn't get the Russians to go along. I guess that's going to be their excuse. But, you know, why set yourself up for something that you know you're going to have to say in the end, you know, this is not going to be realistic. Why not just say that from the beginning? I mean, I think that there's a kind of...
Well, for that matter, he could just say
there's
Obama
almost an
could...
addiction. There's almost an addiction to fiction here on the part of the national
right.
security state, is the way I would put it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, Obama, if he really wanted to face the Republicans down, he would say, look, this whole thing is a manufactured crisis. Read Gareth Porter and shut up.
Exactly.
That's precisely my point.
I think that that they are so averse to telling the truth about things, they don't even know what the truth is anymore, and therefore it's very hard for them you know, to sort of stand up to people who are obviously completely off base and say to them, you know, let's face facts here.
Yeah. Well, God, at least it isn't Hillary Clinton, you know?
Well, it is Hillary Clinton on steroids, is the way I would put it. I mean, that's who they're dealing with. I'm sorry, you're talking about the government itself is not Hillary Clinton.
I mean, at least she ain't the one in charge. I mean, they had to wait until after the sanctions were already dead for her to come out against them in the Senate just, you know, 2 weeks ago. So I'm certain her policy would be worse right now.
We can hope and pray that she's not the next president. But, you know, I would not want to put too much money on that one.
Well, you know, everybody thought she was going to be back, you know, in 2006 and 2007, and then look how wrong that was. So I like to point out that there are basically, what, like 45% of people hate her and will always hate her no matter what. And so that's a pretty high negative to overcome.
High negatives, you're right. On the other hand,
she's terrible in every way, you know?
The Republican Party has even higher negatives at this point.
Well, that's true, too. Yeah, I mean, if she gets the nomination, then it probably is a done deal, but you never know.
That's right.
Yeah, anyway, that's the faintest of praise for our current emperor. I mean, I can't... Honestly, Gareth, if he's wise enough to pursue this agenda at all, and as difficult as it is to accomplish and to pursue it even to the degree that he has already, it, you know, begs the whole question, raises the whole question of why is he so horrible on every other freaking matter of foreign policy whatsoever? I mean, it seems like whatever is the wrong thing to do, he does it. If he knows well enough to do the right thing here at all, to even lean toward the right thing here, to me, it makes it a puzzle of why he's such... he doesn't have to be as bad as he is. He didn't have to start a war in Libya, for example, but he did.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't have to do any of the things that he's done in any legal sense. But, you know, I think as we've talked about many times, you know, the political reality in this country is that, with the exception of Dwight D. Eisenhower, the United States has not had a Cold War or post-Cold War president who had the degree of independence necessary to be able to carry out any rational policies in the field of political and military policy abroad.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the fact is that the war state, the national security state, has had so much power that presidents have been intimidated, even when they knew better, as in the case clearly of, you know, John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson on the case of Vietnam. They knew better. They knew it was a huge mistake. They knew they shouldn't go to war on Vietnam.
But so, in other words, what you're saying is this Iran thing is more a matter of consensus of the establishment and the national security state rather than him grabbing them by the collar and making them go along.
Well, in this case, I mean, look, it's mainly, this policy toward Iran is mainly a matter of the Israeli lobby and the fact that over the years, the national security state people have accepted the Israeli, the Israeli manufactured view of the history of the Iranian nuclear program. That's really, I think, at the bottom of this present impasse or this present problem that we face.
Right. All right. Well, we're over time. We got to go to this break. Thanks very much for your time, as always. Good to talk to you, Gareth.
Thanks again for having me.
All right, everybody. That is Super Gareth, the great Gareth Porter the Great. Author of Manufactured Crisis, all about the fake controversy over Iran's nuclear program, and writer for IPSnews.net. Check him out today at Truthout and at antiwar.com. Hey, you own a business? Maybe we should consider advertising on the show. See if we can make a little bit of money. My email address is scott@scotthorton.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the Dang On Thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. ScottHorton.org is my website. If you value what you hear here, both different spellings in a row there for you, then click on my sponsors. Go and visit their sites, donate to their projects, buy their goods. Support the Scott Horton Show by supporting the show's sponsors there. You can find them all on the right margin at ScottHorton.org. And Horton. Sometimes I can't pronounce my own last name well. Horton. So good. ScottHorton.org. Also, you can follow me on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at /ScottHortonShow. /ScottHortonShow. Okay, good. All right, now, let me see here. Ivan Elon's coming up just a minute. First, I guess the coup in Ukraine. I don't really have any new news for you in Ukraine other than the Americans succeeded in coup d'etat there, with the help of a bunch of Nazi brown shirts out in the streets. People literally proudly displaying, SS lightning bolts, iron crosses, and swastikas, marching around giving each other the Hitler salute. Are you kidding me? These are the liberals, according to American TV news. Gangs of brown shirts. Now, the people who have actually taken power, they're not brown shirt type fascists in the streets. They're more the crony capitalist kind of fascists. Not so much, you know, hard line Nazis, but just kleptocrats in power, you know. But they have certainly seized power from the democratically elected leader. And you know, the American National Security Advisor has threatened Russia that they better not intervene militarily. And so, you know, I guess we're at where the same place we were 24 hours ago. As far as I know, nothing major has changed in the dynamic anywhere. They filed a warrant, murder charges against the former president that they've driven out of power. And, you know, sort of the, I guess, kind of a repeat of what I was saying yesterday. The most important lesson for Americans here, other than just how dangerous the Democrats are, that they're willing to pick a fight with the Russians over Ukraine like this. The other major lesson is the cravenness and ignorance. I don't want to say craven ignorance because they're two different kinds of things going on here. The cravenness and the ignorance, both of them serving each other, both of those traits, attributes serving each other in the American media here when they talk about Ukraine. Hey, whatever, if the U.S. government obviously has a certain agenda here, then the truth is whatever makes them look good, whatever makes them sound right, that's the only principle at stake when the script is written for these TV news hairdos for reading off their teleprompters. Yes, freedom has been saved from the clutches of villainy. No question of whether America's backing Nazis. No question of whether the president they overthrew was democratically elected a couple of years ago. No question of whether anyone in Ukraine actually supported that government. No question of anything. You know, even their most basic, well, people who love freedom and are embracing Western values are winning the day in Ukraine. Any questions that are even raised by their own script, they don't answer. The most obvious follow-ups to their own script, they just ignore. And you know, it was hilarious. I saw on, I guess it was on Jon Stewart last night. Was it Jon Stewart? I think it was. Where he interviewed this guy from the Council on Foreign Relations. The editor of Foreign Affairs magazine, actually. Saying, well, you know, what we're doing over there is we're trying to run away with Ukraine. We're getting away with it. Ha ha ha. And we think it's working and they can't stop us. And he even mocks Putin saying, yeah, we decided to do this during the Olympics while he's distracted in Sochi. And then so that provides, you know, Jon Stewart to make a little joke about how, oh, hey, yeah, look over here while we're doing this. Instead of just asking the important question, which is, come on, really? You think that Vladimir Putin is distracted by the Olympics so much that he doesn't know what you're doing in Ukraine? What do you think you're really getting away with? Does America have the right to run off with Ukraine? And it was funny because the guy, he picked his words very carefully. He said they're pro-Western, pro-European, anti-Russian, but he didn't try to pretend that they're Democrats. Some of them are actual Nazis waving swastikas around. So at least he didn't, you know, break that topic open. But, you know, Jon Stewart, try as he might, he didn't really have grounding in any contrary argument. So he's basically accepting what this guy's saying. I mean, it seems to be the consensus on TV that this is the right thing to do, right? That America should be peeling away states away from Russian influence and bring them into our orbit. And our orbit may extend as far as Ukraine, but okay. That's not to be questioned. What interest of the Americans this served or serves in any sense is never brought up. Other than that everybody knows already. Unquestioned, unproven, unprovable premise that, yeah, of course, America must rule the world. Pinky and the brain style. And anyone who opposes us must be crushed sooner or later one way or the other. And so the Cold War continues. And the people in Ukraine who have every reason to hate Russia and resent Russia and hate Russian influence and want them out, those people are just stuck. Tough for them, sorry, but they don't get to have their own policy. If they fight for what they believe in, then they're just the sock puppets of the American Empire. And if they quit, then they're the sock puppets of the Russians that they hate so much too. And that's unfortunate. And it's not their fault. It's the Americans' fault. for making Ukraine America's empire's business. Hey, you know what? What if by happenstance you were from some other country where your entire nation is just a pawn in the games of the greater powers? Wouldn't that suck? You try to overthrow your government, but actually you're just serving one foreign power or the other if you do, that kind of thing? That's not fair. And anyway, the solution in almost all of these cases is the same. Secession. Let everyone secede from everyone else. You don't own other people anyway. So give up on the pretense that some geographical boundary leaves them by any right subject to your authority. And you know what? In Ukraine, it couldn't be more east and west split. In the east, they're Orthodox. In the west, they're Catholic. In the east, they speak Russian. In the west, they speak Ukrainian. In the east, they like the Russians. In the west, they would rather be part of the European community, so-called. So let them split. And for God's sake, don't try to kick the Russians out of Crimea, the Crimean Peninsula there, sticking down in the Black Sea. It's their military base. It ain't ours. It's their sea, sorta. It sure as hell is not America's. And so, let them split. In fact, I think America could probably get Russia to agree to that. Let's go ahead and let Ukraine split in half. Along the obvious lines. And let there be a 10-year cooling-off period for people to change sides of the lines before they're stuck on the wrong side of the line. You know, don't make a real problem, but secession, it works. It could be good. You know, some circumstances. Oh, by the way, I wanted to bring up, what's his name from Ghostbusters, man? All of a sudden, his name escapes me. All of a sudden, you know who I'm talking about. The guy with glasses, Egon. He died. Harold Ramis. And he's the guy that made Ghostbusters and Caddyshack and a couple other things. And I usually don't talk about things like this because I don't really care about things like this. But in this case, I'm going to bring it up because I think that thinking back on it, and someone else mentioned this is what got me thinking back on it. Someone else wrote an article about this. Ghostbusters is a pretty libertarian movie. And when I was a little kid in the 80s, I think I kind of already was like this. But Ghostbusters kind of helped confirm my voice of reason that said that government agents are the scum of the earth, all of them. And the bad guy in Ghostbusters, the red-haired, red-bearded guy, who's also the bad guy from Real Genius with Val Kilmer, which you've all seen 1,000 times if you have TNT. That guy, he played the best kind of horrible bad guy in the 80s. Kind of stuck-up, smarmy, power-monger, Democrat, do-gooder type. He's just disgusting, that guy. The red-beard guy from Ghostbusters. The EPA agent that comes and foments the crisis by shutting down the thing. And anyway, I already hated the state because I was born free and I'm just kind of like that. But I think kind of, you know, Ghostbusters was probably pretty important. Sort of like the first song on the second side of Master of Puppets is Disposable Heroes. About the veterans of the good wars, right? Never mind, you know, Vietnam or the forgotten war in Korea. Disposable Heroes, pretty sure that's about World War II. And anyway, there's nothing good about that good war. Help confirm my own voice of reason as a young kid. I like to think back on things like that, you know? Star Wars, obviously. But you know what? Ghostbusters, too. And also Caddyshack, where the judge is completely despicable. Contrary to all other TV propaganda where I'm supposed to respect these people, the judge on Caddyshack is the devil. And any power that he was ever, exercising over anyone in his day job clearly was arbitrary and capricious. And he had no right to be the judge of anyone. And that's Harold Ramis' attitude right there, man. I read a thing about that. It was a quote of him saying, you know, our job is afflicting power, right? Like he's a journalist. We're on the side of the little guy against power. And I think his movies, to some degree or another, kind of, you know, reinforced that. And as a kid growing up on them, I think they reinforced my very positive anti-government extremist attitude. So I thank his corpse for that. Thanks, Harold Ramis' corpse.
And you don't believe the propaganda about
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson is a successful former hedge fund manager who provides his subscribers with a very real window into his investments, updating them on every move he makes in the markets. Right now, Mike's anticipating a bear and is dumping all his stocks while the getting is good, investing instead in gold and the commodities. Protect your assets and learn the wise ways of the markets. WallStreetWindow.com. And check out Mike Swanson's great contribution to the history of the rise of the American Empire and the war state. Available at scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our next guest is Ivan Eland. He is Senior Fellow and Director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independent Institute, that's independent.org, and he's the author of The Empire Wears No Clothes, Recarving Rushmore, and most recently, No War for Oil, U.S. Dependency, and the Middle East. Welcome back to the show. Ivan, how are you doing?
Thanks for having me on, Scott.
Very happy to have you here. First of all, let's talk about this book. When did it come out?
Well, it came out a couple years ago. I've actually got a new book on counterinsurgency, the failure of counterinsurgencies, though it's a little bit newer, but the No War for Oil book is still quite relevant, and even more so with U.S. discoveries of oil here in the U.S. The book basically says, well, we shouldn't fight a war for a resource that we can get by buying it, and of course, it's even more so since we can buy it more of it within our own borders. But that's really kind of irrelevant. But and the counterinsurgency book goes into the history of counterinsurgency warfare and why they usually fail, and it specifically mentions other cases besides the failure in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Oh, okay, great. Well, geez, I want to talk about both of those subjects still before we get into the budget and also North Korea. First of all, as far as no war for oil, you say it's irrelevant. I think that's probably the most important point there about what's irrelevant. You were saying is, whether we have oil resources here or not. Oil's expensive enough now that it makes economic sense to get it out of the shale and the tar sands
right. And
all this.
Yeah, but the principle of the book is let the free market decide, we let it decide on many other things. Oil is really not a strategic commodity. It was only created, that conception was only created out of thin air by the British Navy when they went from coal to oil. And, of course, they had coal in England, and they needed to get their oil from somewhere else. So that made them conscious of oil being not in within their boundaries. And, of course, that idea that oil was somehow strategic has migrated to other countries, such as the Germans during World War II and the U.S. Now, and it really shouldn't. Now, this new, and of course, the reason I was saying that it's even more so now that we're more irrelevant, now that we're producing more, was because the canard that we need to be independent of foreign oil is really nonsense, because if you want to do that, you're going to have to pay a lot more for oil and other forms of energy. If you want to be oil independent, energy independent, whatever, what they don't tell you is you're going to pay a lot more. And as you point out, the reason that we're have an oil boom here in the U.S. is because the price of oil is high enough that it makes these more expensive extraction methods from shale competitive in the market. If the price of oil goes down, you will see some of that oil production in the U.S. dry up quickly.
Mm-hmm. But so, really is rare, as you're well aware, of course, is what made you write the book in the first place, I'm sure, to try to challenge this consensus, left, right, Republican, Democrat, either Coast or Houston, Texas, or anybody else. Everybody says it matters or not, one way or the other. It's very important whether we are energy independent. Of course, as long as we have to get oil out of the Middle East, then we have to be militarily intervening over there all the time. So let me put to you this way. You call it a canard. What if there was not a drop of oil in Texas? What if there was no oil in America, and we really did have to get all of our oil from Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, Russia, somewhere else? Don't we need to secure that oil? It's still nothing but a canard, Ivan?
Yes. We don't talk about 70 to 80% of our semiconductors come from East Asia, but nobody talks about you know, using military force to ensure that the supply lines for semiconductors are, and, you know, semiconductors go into everything, right? So this is an idea that is ridiculous. I mean, there are many products that we don't produce here in the United States. Strategic ones, or you have to put the strategic in quotes because none of them are really strategic. But, you know, things like we have other things like that are not strategic by any stretch of the imagination, like bananas. You know, do we grow any bananas in the United States? Probably not. And so, you know, efficient trades means certain countries are better at either manufacturing or growing or extracting minerals better than other countries. And that's why we have international trade. And even if we don't produce any oil here, there are many sources of oil. As you point out, Russia, the Persian Gulf, there's some in the North Sea, there's off Alaska, northern Canada, et cetera. So there's many sources of oil, and we really don't need to use military power to safeguard stuff that the market will bring to us. I mean, oil has gone around wars and even through wars, because sometimes, like Iran-Iraq war, the two countries were trading, were swapping oil, even as they were blasting away at each other. So, you know, countries trade with each other even when they're at war. So the idea that we really need to have, you know, guaranteed supplies of oil. The other interesting thing about it is, you know, if you go by the price as being the value of something, the platinum group metals are even more valuable than oil, and they're actually used in cracking petroleum molecules from the bigger oil, crude oil molecules into the smaller gasoline and diesel fuel molecules. But nobody says that, you know, we need to use military power to safeguard these. We've had a shortage of oil tankers. We had a shortage of refining capabilities after Katrina. But did anyone say, well, we need to be, you know, independent, completely independent of foreign refining or foreign tankers or whatever? So, you know, the problem is your supply line is the one is as vulnerable as the weakest link. And of course, there's always another link. But the miracle of the market is that most of the people have an incentive rather than to interdict the price of, you know, the commodity of oil, the selling of oil, or platinum group metals or, you know, oil tankers or whatever. Mm-hmm. They have an incentive because they can make money to not impede those shipments. And therefore, if you're willing to pay for this stuff, you can get it.
Right. It's funny, too, that, you know, when you bring up that, well, you know, if we had to diversify, there are all these other sources to go to. I can't think of why anyone in the Middle East would want to stop selling us oil unless it was some kind of short-term revenge for us either waging war against them in the name of securing oil or debasing our currency to wage war against somebody else in the name of securing oil over there and buying their oil and depreciating dollars like what precipitated the boycott back in the 70s. But otherwise, if we would just leave them the hell alone, they'd have every interest in doing nothing but sell us oil anyway.
Right. Well, the most of those countries over there are like from 75% to 90% of their foreign exchange and exports is oil, right? And so they'd be foolish. They have no diversity in their economies or very little diversity, and therefore they have a tremendous incentive. They probably need to sell the oil more than we need to buy it. The other, I think, you know, the other thing that to remember is that you know, it's expensive to keep these armies over there for something that may never happen. That is a war that is so bad that the oil shipments can't go around it or through it, right? And so, if you take oil off the world market, the price will go up. If you put more oil on the market, the price will go down. So all you're going to have to do is pay more for oil. And in fact, most of this fear is caused by the 73 oil embargo, which was actually a failure. And the Saudi oil minister who orchestrated the embargo even admitted publicly later that it was a fraud. So the supplies just reordered, and there was a lot of fear in the markets. But, in fact, you never saw another oil embargo after that because it was such a failure for the Arabs.
Right. All right. Now, I want to ask you about about coin real quick before we get into the budget, which, you know, will bring us right back to the subject of the empire in the Middle East and elsewhere. But on the matter of the counterinsurgency doctrine, it always seemed to me like the entire discussion over there at the Center for a New American Security and all that, the so-called coin Denistas, especially when they're talking about, you know, supposedly copying the Iraqi surge in Afghanistan and all that, that they were taking the context of who they were and who their enemies were and all that out and reducing it down to like a board game or something, whereas like McNamara's whiz kids crunching numbers and saying that, you know, according to our formula, we ought to be able to change this entire society or something, without even looking at the fact of who it was that they're fighting. The Pashtun tribes who don't lose and haven't lost in 2,000 years or whatever it is. So I just was wondering if you could explain how it is that these guys convince themselves of what we can see all in front of our eyes right now, a complete failure of a policy, this surge and counterinsurgency doctrine as deployed in Afghanistan from 2009 through, say, 11 and a half.
Well, the premise of the counterinsurgency doctrine that is you don't go blasting your way into every place and alienating the people, because guerrillas, unlike conventional armies, they hide in the sea of the people, right? And they're hidden. Well, of course, but so the counterinsurgency doctrine is you give candy out to kids and you get candy out to adults, essentially, you know, water projects or aid or whatever, and you want the people to love you. And but the problem that with that is and this is an example of the illustrated by the drone policy. Our drones actually kill less people than the Taliban does, civilians, yet we get more blame than the Taliban does. Why do we get more blame? Because we're foreigners. Taliban live there, right? And therefore, the people excuse brutality from locals more than they do the foreign invader. So when you're fighting a counterinsurgency war and you're a foreign invader, you have all the cards stacked against you except one, and that's technology. But in counterinsurgency warfare, technology is much less useful than in a conventional war. So you may have the most powerful military in the world, which the United States has. It has the most powerful military of all time in world history, relatively and absolutely, and yet it's just lost to a counterinsurgency war. We don't hear that much in the media because our media likes to rah-rah behind the team as well, but they have been lost. And, of course, if Libya was not a counterinsurgency warfare, it was air war, but that's been a disaster after we toppled the dictator. So we go in and try to mold these societies either by counterinsurgency warfare or by a quick airstrike, like in air campaign, like in Kosovo or Libya or someplace like that. And you know, we have the same result: is we have chaos. And when we try to intervene and bring our own values or our own political structures, they're not very well suited to the places that we're trying to take them. And so I think there's the guerrilla warfare is more political than military, and we excel at military stuff but not political stuff.
All right, we got to hold it right there and take this short break. It's Ivan Elin from the Independent Institute and antiwar.com and the Huffington Post, and we're talking about we've been talking about the failure of coin and war for oil, but North Korea and defense spending coming up next. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe. Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future of Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. I'm on the phone with Ivan Elin. He's a senior fellow at the Independent Institute. That's independent.org. Very, very libertarian there at independent.org. He's the director of the Center on Peace and Liberty there, and has a regular column, of course, at antiwar.com as well. And so now there's big news. The New York Times version, Ivan, says Pentagon plans to shrink army to pre-World War II levels. I'm sure you're buying that, and then I guess secondarily, you must be really enthusiastic, huh?
Well, Not really. It's an improvement. I think the army has to be reduced. It was pumped up, of course. It depends on what you call reduced. Of course, it was pumped up to 570,000 people during the ground wars, and now we're going to go back to 440 to 450,000. Of course, we still have a lot of reserves and guardsmen as well, so it's not like that's the only people that we have there. The other problem with that is that when people say it's the smallest army since before World War II, they're comparing the army to a time when the army hadn't been built up yet, and of course, the army now is much different. It's more high tech. You need fewer soldiers. I mean, in the first part of the Iraq invasion, we demonstrated that less soldiers supporting air power could, of course, take out probably any army on the planet. And so we can reduce the army, and we can probably reduce it even further than it's being reduced here. So I wouldn't say that that this is too drastic. I would say that we probably ought to consider doing even more than they're doing, and that they're kind of not facing up to the real issues and the real cuts that need to be made.
Yeah, but I think you're forgetting that Barack Obama is a secret Kenyan commie Nazi selling this country out. And Dick Cheney came out and said that, you know, oh, yeah, sure, you got plenty of money for food stamps, but no money for defending this country. What about that?
Well, of course, our military really doesn't defend the country, as it proved on 9/11 when it sent fighter jets out into the ocean. Our military isn't configured to defend the country at all. In fact, our military is an offensive power projection force. And, of course, George Bush probably came close to the truth when he said after 9/11, the best offense is a good defense. Or did he say, no, the best defense is a good offense, sorry. And so, of course, that's how we feel, is that anything, we call it defense, but it's really, it should be called the Department of Offense or the Department of Defense of other countries, because we spend a lot of money defending South Korea, Japan, and still Europe, even though there's not much of a threat there anymore. So, and of course, many other countries around the world, Taiwan, and now we're getting more heavily involved in Africa. So we project our forces around, but very little of this has to do with defending the country. And you could actually make the argument that the Iraq War and the Afghan War dredged up more terrorism, which, of course, the terrorism was caused in the first place by people not liking our foreign interventions overseas. So whether the military is actually defending the country, I think is no. You'll find almost nobody saying that. But I think a really dispassionate analyst would say, well, let's examine this. The more we intervene overseas, the more our citizens are at risk of terrorism, both at home and abroad. So I think we could probably reduce the military, use it for only in rare cases when we actually had to defend the country. Mm-hmm. And we would all be safer than having a big military that's globe-girdling and, interventionist superpower.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, when they were having all those debates about the sequester and whether the automatic cuts were going to kick in at the Pentagon and that kind of thing, and they really are, I guess, just talking about curbing the rate of growth and all that, what counts for a cut in D.C.? But, of course, all the generals were squawking, and I can't remember who it was. It seems like it must have been an article, but someone had compiled a YouTube like this, too, or something. I'm trying to remember my source here, but there was a great kind of compilation of quotes of these military men warning specifically the Congress in testimony before the House and the Senate that, hey, listen, if you do these cuts, I am not going to be able to go and wage a war on the far end of the planet at a moment's notice or anything like that. So you guys got to know that that's what you're sacrificing if these cuts go into effect. And it was one of those things where, I mean, it's kind of a wrong figure of speech, but I don't know a better one about like out of the mouths of babes or whatever, where these guys don't realize how this might sound to a ear biased against them in any way. And they're just being completely honest about it, that, hey, you know, conflicts at the outer reaches of the empire, you know, fires break out, I may not be available to go put them out for you, Senator. Are you sure that's what you want? And the question of defending America never even came up at all. And no one was even embarrassed. That's what I mean about out of the mouths of babies. It was
a naive
discussion because no one even was recognizing that. Wow, we really are a bunch of imperialists, aren't we?
Well, of course, if we really wanted to defend the country for and spend as little money as possible, we'd probably have a Coast Guard and some nuclear weapons and call it a day, right? That no one's going to attack us if we have a nuclear arsenal that can, you know, do that, but you know, to incinerate their country. Now, that may not be the way you want to go. Maybe you don't want nuclear weapons. Maybe you want a more capable but still very much smaller conventional force. But still, my point is that the amount of forces that you would need to actually defend the country is much smaller. And, of course, this always gets lost. Our security is taken to be so wide. Well, they don't say strictly defense. What they'll say is, well, our national interests, we can't defend our national interests, or national security is in peril if we make these cuts. And, of course, they don't say, well, we can't defend the nation with this, because, of course, everybody knows that they really probably could defend the nation quite easily with even with the cuts. So, but this idea that we have to have this defense perimeter clear out, you know, defending, as Frederick the Great said, who was a famous military, Prussian military general, he said, to defend everything is to defend nothing. And, of course, that's what the U.S. has been doing since 1945, is defending everything in the world. And, of course, on 9/11, we saw that that didn't work out too well, especially when terrorists can get behind your defenses. In fact, if you're battling terrorism, George Bush's slogan that the best defense is a good offense, which may be good in a tactical battlefield sense sometimes, but when dealing with terrorists, that's quite the opposite of what you should be doing. You should be doing defense and law enforcement.
All right, now, I want to ask you, too, about the planes, because it seems to me, best I can tell, as far as anybody paying attention to this, that other than those who are in on the scam, there's an entire consensus against the F-22 and the F-35, and that our old F-15s, F-16s, F-18s are plenty good to be the world's policemen or whatever else, to dominate the air over any other nation in the world just fine without these new ridiculous $200 million apiece hunks of junk. And I was wondering if you think that there's any group anywhere that's not just, you know, immediately being paid off, you know, Lockheed lobbyists or their counterparts in the Air Force or in the Congress, whatever, who disagree. Because it seems like everywhere I can tell, people are going, hell, an F-15 can kill you from 300 miles away. So what is it? What the hell would we need an F-35 for?
Well, that's the problem that they've had since the end of the Cold War, is justifying these planes. The threat to the F-22 were Russia, Soviet planes that were never built. So, of course, did we build the F-22? Of course we did. And are we going to build the F-35? Yes, we are, because much of the defense budget is pork. And what I mean by pork is it's constituency groups getting jobs and defense contracts in their district. And defense spending is a political business. Dwight Eisenhower is quite correct about the military-industrial complex, and I would add Congress in there too. You know, these defense industries lobby the Hill. The Hill wants to bring jobs home to the congressional districts in the states so they can get reelected. So, of course, they vote for this stuff, and defense is such a political industry that subcontractors, the big defense contractors, have subcontractors, but they put them in like every state. You don't get the subcontractor because you provide the highest quality product at the lowest prices in private business. So I think we have to distinguish commercial business from a private sector defense business, because these companies may be private, but they're doling out subcontracts on the basis of putting them in every state rather than buying the best product, right? So a lot of defense contracting is shoddy, it's behind schedule, and it's politically insulated from any competition. And so it's basically a lot of the weapons that are built are not necessarily the logical ones, but the ones that have the most political power and can avoid cuts.
Mm-hmm. And then, real quickly, is the F-35 as bad of a catastrophe as I'm led to believe?
Well, it is the most expensive weapon system ever, and it was supposed to be designed as a low-cost replacement for the F-16. But, of course, it's like every other defense contractor, and probably even a contract, and even worse, is it's over budget, behind schedule, and the performance is vastly decreased. So I think what you're going to see is a disaster, and even if it's not a disaster, they'll limp along as most defense programs do, and maybe eventually put out something which doesn't work all that well and cost too much. So I think it probably should just be canceled, because as you point out, with modern command and control systems and electronic systems, you can refurbish old planes. The old plane's just a platform nowadays to hang weapons and stuff on. You've got weapons on there. You've got superior sensors. You can take older planes, put superior sensors and weapons on them, and they'll fly just fine against other newer aircraft from other countries.
Well, when it comes to fighter jets, it's all about the training, you know, more than the
actual aircraft.
Yes,
that's also
anyway.
True. Yes, that's one of the other things, mm-hmm. is if we have good pilots, and our pilots are the best in the world, I would argue even better than Israeli pilots, and therefore we have so many advantages in air combat that we don't need to be buying any new planes.
Yeah. All right, well, I'm sorry we didn't get a chance to talk about North Korea, but hopefully I'll have you back on soon and we can talk about that, because I like your North Korea policy, Ivan. So.
Okay, thanks a lot, Scott.
Thanks very much for your time. Everybody, that's the great Ivan Elin, antiwar.com, independent.org. War for Oil and the Failure of Counterinsurgency is his latest book. See you tomorrow, guys. Thanks for listening.